Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is an expert on organized crime, the FBI, and the Mueller investigation of Donald Trump and many other high-profile legal cases, Andrew Weissman. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, and don't forget to tell us where you're from. Please check out the link to our sponsors, Lomi, in the show notes. We thank you for supporting our sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. James, we're going to talk to Andrew Weissman. Couldn't have a better guest about the legal considerations and the implications of the special counsels on Biden and Trump on classified documents. And he'll spell out the differences. But let's us just talk about just the politics of it. Does it affect either one as far as 2024 is concerned?
No. All the Democrats need to do, and listen very closely because I'm going to say this repeatedly, simply say the president and his entire administration is cooperating with the independent counsel. That's it. Okay. Nothing
right.
else.
But that, okay? That's on the council. Let's just talk about the politics of it. That's okay. What we're going to. Andrew can talk about that.
Right. No, but that's the politics. Okay. Understand, right. I'm giving the most political answer you can imagine.
So it has no effect on Biden. How about on Trump?
Well, let's talk to Andrew about the Trump case. I can only speak to the Biden case. And the next time I see some long-faced Democrat on cable news talking about, I'm very concerned about this, I'm going to jump out of my skin, okay? What you ought to be saying is there's a secret 3-page written document that outlines the sleazy deal that Kevin McCarthy made with these extreme right wingers. And why haven't these 18 Republicans who elected and district Biden carried asked to see it? Don't say anything more than the president and his administration are cooperating.
All right, let's move then to that to the House. As part of that deal, the part that we know, McCarthy put the four horsemen of the apocalypse on the House Oversight Committee. I mean, this is what a collection. Paul Gosar, whose own siblings say he is totally unfit for office. Scott Perry, who sought a pardon from President Trump for his efforts to overturn the election. And Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert now in a big fight over who's crazier. I think it's a tie. This is a clown show, and this is what Kevin McCarthy, this is the hand I guess he was dealt, but it's a hand he's playing, and James, I have a feeling that it's going to really backfire on him.
I wouldn't even talk about them. I would talk about the 18. Do you have any idea on what you voted for? Do you have any idea? Did you ask what deals were made? I would say that Tom Kaine's son and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar are the same people, all right? Tom Kaine's son and the 17 others like him voted for something that they had no idea what was in it.
James, let's tell people what you're talking about the 18. I would amend it to the 17 because one of them is George Santos. These are Republicans who were elected in districts that Biden carried.
Correct.
So take out George Santos. Right, there's 17. And there are also, by the way, three others who won by less than one point, including Lauren Boebert. So you have a bunch.
You have a bunch. And you're not going to beat Marjorie Taylor Greene. Just use her as a prop. Go after the 20. And all of them, I guarantee you, you go dig up their spots. They all talked about can-do and Washington is dysfunctional and blah, 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 blah. That's who to focus on. That's totally who the folks are. And there is a deal that was made that we don't know. They don't know what the hell they're voting on. And make them pay a price, a big one.
And it was clearly private. There was a story today that I think his name is Vern Buchanan, a congressman from Florida, who was scheduled to be on the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. And instead, in a bit of a surprise, it went to, Congressman Smith of, I believe, Missouri. And that was because he was big for Kevin McCarthy and he cut that private deal. And Buchanan did not know about it. Until they voted. Now, what other stuff is there? What other stuff is there on votes? What other stuff is there on impeachments? What other stuff is there on ethics? You're right. There's a whole host of things.
Correct. And that is the conversation that is to be had. Not a investigation that's going to turn up diddly squat. All right? That's where all of the focus of the Democrats should be. Where's the three pages? Could you look for it? I asked my colleagues, do you have any idea what you're voting on? And McCarthy and, Vern Buchanan is a very wealthy guy. I think he's a car dealer, like in Sarasota.
Yeah, he is.
And he thought they got the majority. He thought he was going to be committee chair. Well, stuck the shib in him pretty good. And if I was Vern Buchanan, I'd turn on him. He didn't care. He didn't need the money, and he has no interest in just being a flunky in Kevin McCarthy's army.
I may be wrong because of the redistricting. They could have changed it, but that wasn't a solid R seat. And if that's still the case, his biggest threat is to resign.
I think his son. I'm not sure. I'm talking about something that I've hazy memory, but I think he's grooming his son. To take the seat, but I'll look at it.
Yeah.
But I do remember it was competitive at one time because I went down there and campaigned for somebody that lost.
Well, they ought to go, and you're right, that'll be the focus. Now, the clown show is going to force their hand on some things earlier, though. They plan, they say, rather quickly to move to impeach the Homeland Security chief, Mayorkas, who there's no cause for that whatsoever. It'd be the first cabinet member to be impeached in 147 years. This is the lunatic fringe, and that's where you go back to the 17. And I think what's lost sometimes in some of the coverage is those seven, actually it's 20. I call them the timid 20. That's important. You know, if you said the timid 20, because you add those three who won by 1 point, they are the people that control the House. Not the Freedom Caucus. They are the ones that can decide. They're the margin. Anytime McCarthy loses four or five of those, he's dead. And the question is, do they have the will, the guts? I mean, some of them are afraid they'll be primaried next time. Some of them are afraid about losing money. But those are the people you mentioned, Tom Kaine. They're five from New York. They're five from California.
The guy from Nebraska.
Omaha. Right. And those people are the balance of power.
Make them pay. Bring it up constantly, relentlessly. Make them pay. Put the microphone in their mouths. All right? That's the art of politics. And the Democrats don't do that very well because they get distracted and they answer other stuff and they want to show people how smart they are or how independent they are. Bring it up all the time. You're exactly right. It's 20 people, it's 19, it's 21. It's a whole bunch. And they are not comfortable. They are not feeling very comfortable now. And the idea is to make them feel more uncomfortable.
Yeah, right. I like 20 because I like the alliteration.
Yeah, it's nice
the, the timid 20. That's who they are. And you can know. I'll tell you something. In the weeks ahead, we'll start to name them. I mean, in case anyone, is.
Yeah. You can name them. They
know who they are.
Doing it. If you live by them, spineless, gutless, go along to get along. But for God's sakes, don't say that the problem solvers. All right, but every Republican on that, you don't know what they're doing to solve the problem.
Right.
We've got to hit the living crap out of this.
Yeah, totally agree. And Some enterprising reporter, maybe even get some bloodhounds, find that three pages.
Yes,
that's,
indeed.
That's the key. Okay, we'll be on this, I promise, for the next weeks and months ahead.
We will. I just hope that these long faces I see on cable TV, these Democrats harumping about how troubling this is, pivot, as Gergen would say, pivot to the timid 20.
Okay. Hey, James, we have the perfect guest this week. Andrew Weissman, vast experience in criminal justice, head of the criminal division at the Justice Department, general counsel to the FBI, and the top member of the Mueller investigation of Donald Trump and the Russian ties. Andrew, first, welcome back. Special counsels are looking into both Trump and President Biden having classified documents in their personal possession. Tell our listeners what are the similarities, but what are the differences between these two cases?
Well, you can't write this in a movie script, the idea that you have two special counsels investigating the current and former president for mishandling classified documents and government documents is just sort of unreal. So it's important to know we don't know a lot of the facts, particularly with respect to the Biden situation, but at least what we do know currently, to date, is the differences are much greater than the similarities, because from a Department of Justice perspective, the key things that differentiate them, I think, will be the key things that differentiate between recommending going forward with a criminal case and not going forward with a criminal case. So in the former president's case, while we don't have great insight into why the documents were taken or exactly how they ended up at Mar-a-Lago, there's some evidence, but not a lot. We have really good evidence that once they got there, the former president knew they were there. He willfully retained them. He refused to give them back. And he may be also responsible for sort of repeated acts of obstruction in not returning them. And with President Biden, again, we don't have a lot of insight about how the documents got to the Penn Biden Center and to his personal home. The volume of documents is a lot smaller, but there isn't any evidence that once he appears to have known that the documents were there, that he knowingly retained them, that he tried to hide them from the government. In other words, that he still didn't return them. In fact, he, by all accounts, he appears to have returned them immediately and has not obstructed justice in the course of that. So those are the sort of big differences. And I should add, though, that none of that explains what has been, at the very least, since we're on a podcast and we're free to speak in any way we want, you know, the really sort of crappy way in which he and his staff have dealt with the communications to the public about what happened.
Yeah, they claim that they didn't want to interfere with the Justice Department, but that really doesn't hold water. I mean, I certainly agree with you that the cases are, you know, the Trump case is far more serious. But wouldn't Biden have been better off releasing that information, you know, a month or two earlier?
So without the benefit of knowing exactly what the facts were before them, and also without in any way suggesting that the people involved are bad people or up to no good, because I know some of them, and like, you know, so Bob Bauer, you know, is at NYU and he's a terrific guy and he's honest as the day is long. But getting to your question, yeah, I think people should stop underestimating the American people. I think there would have been nothing wrong with just being super candid about what happened and what the facts were. And I don't even understand this idea of why that would in any way interfere with a government investigation. I mean, DOJ is not going to have told the White House not to speak. This was not a covert investigation where you were asking somebody not to speak about something. So I just don't understand the, we didn't speak because of DOJ, because eventually they did speak and did issue press releases and did speak to reporters. So if they didn't, what, did DOJ's position change on whether you could speak or not? I just don't think that's terribly plausible. So I just don't know why they weren't more upfront earlier, because in many ways, the worst facts and the reasons for suspicion are the communications that they've had about this rather than the underlying facts. But as I said, we'll also see. I mean, there is an issue about what both the current and former president were doing with classified information in their respective locations. I mean, I've dealt with classified information when I was in the government. The idea that it would be in my house is you know, hard to understand.
Well, you you know, I suspect both these special counsels, Jack Smith and Robert Hur, you also know the way the Justice Department weighs these matters. Given, and I suspect you're absolutely right, or your suspicions are absolutely right, that the Trump case is far more serious. There's far more of a maybe even lying, and certainly not turning over documents when asked for it. But as they consider this, does the Biden revelations make it harder for them to indict Trump?
I've discussed that with my friends, and I think that I'm going to give you a lawyer's answer, which you're going to hate, which is it kind of does and doesn't. I think at the Department of Justice, if you're looking at this just as how lawyers are going to look at it, at the department, what you are paid to do and your job is focusing on the facts and the law and DOJ precedent for how the department has handled things in the past and making those distinctions. So distinguishing what we know from about the Biden case from what we know about the Trump case is what you're paid to do. And so in that sense, I don't think it will have any effect on Jack Smith in making his recommendation, and it shouldn't have any effect on Rob Hur in making his recommendation. And obviously, the Attorney General will be able to weigh both of those and also to make sure that they're being treated comparably to other Department of Justice cases. And I should say, having looked at a lot of the department's cases dealing with classified information, the department's cases would, I think, make a truly compelling case for why you have to go forward with respect to Donald Trump, because people who've done far less than he appears to have done have been prosecuted. And with respect to Biden, there's no really good precedent from what we know. And I was looking at the Gonzalez case, for instance, Alberto Gonzalez, who there was a declination, and he appears to have done something pretty minimal, but worse than Biden, and there was a declination in that case. But having said all that about how the department works, I think in terms of the American public, I think that if there is a Mar-a-Lago indictment of Donald Trump, I think it will be harder to get the public to understand and accept why he is being treated that way and Biden is not. And this is an unusual situation where having public acceptance and support for the case and understanding why this is an application of the rule of law and that he's being treated comparably to others is really critical to the country.
James.
So, Andrew, you've been a part of hanging around high-end federal law enforcement a lot, in terms of experience. Can you offer me a reason why in the entire history of the FBI and also there has never been a Democratic FBI director, and why since Watergate there has never been a Democratic special counsel? I'm just wondering, because this is written on the tablet in marble right over the Capitol building. There shall be no Democrats director of the FBI or appointed special counsel. Can you offer me a reason?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about, is that really true with respect to the special counsel? I mean, I know
true.
Archibald Cox.
I went through We don't know what Jack Smith is.
Let me just interfere for a minute, James. Jake Stein, who did Ed Meese, was a Democrat. So there's one exception, but your point is generally right.
And was Archibald Cox a Republican?
Well, I looked at Wikipedia. I looked at the Wikipedia, and by my count, I think it was before this, it was nine Republicans, no Democrats, two of intermediate. But I you can look it up. But at any rate, why do we always have to, if we're investigating a Republican, well, we've got to get a Republican. If we're investigating a Democrat, well, we've got to get a Democrat. Are there no good Democrat? Are there no good Democratic lawyers? So, it's a serious question.
No. What you really might be saying is, why are the Democrats so fearful of, in order to have legitimacy, you have to appoint somebody of the same party, whereas the Republicans have that view? And look, Robert, I work for Robert Mueller, who I enormously respect, and you know, there, it didn't help anything in terms of his credibility that he was a Republican. He still was subject to the same attacks as if he had been a Democrat. And it's obvious that Merrick Garland, in choosing both John Lausch and Rob Herr, was clearly trying to find people who are Republicans to do this, so that there was not the same kind of attack that there was on me and others in the special counsel. So, you know, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, that's, to me, James, that's right. More in your bailiwick than mine. On the FBI, it is kind of worth noting, I guess, a couple things. One, we haven't really had that many FBI directors. It's very, very few. And this is sort of contrary to sort of the Trump attack on the FBI and sort of law enforcement and the intelligence community in general. When I think of it, the FBI, you don't think this is a hotbed of Democratic liberalism and sort of never Trumpers. I mean, you know, I always made this joke that I thought I was probably the most liberal person at the Bureau. And then I went off to NYU Law School and I was the most conservative person there. It's a pretty conservative place. And it may be that that kind of person is both drawn to leadership in that kind of institution, and it may make it easier. But there also is a real history of somebody being impartial. I mean, you know, when you think of Bob Mueller, you don't really think, oh, he is a political figure and he's aligned with, you know, Republicans or Democrats or independents. I mean, he was, you know, for Washington, he was sort of this odd unicorn because he was so apolitical and wanted to keep his head down from all of that. And, you know, and I think that is a useful trait to have. I should say, I think Jack Smith may have been a Republican early on. And then I think the longer he was sort of in the department, I think he switched to being an independent. But I think he's an independent now.
So,
yeah, I think that's right.
You know, and this guy Gleason, okay, he's a retired judge. He, you know, President Clinton appointed a federal bench. He's just badass and impartial to ever come down the pike. But, you know, they could have never appointed him because not just the Democrats, but the whole press would have said, no, you have to have a Republican. That's the way you get the investigation, gets credibility. But I have another question, a legal question for you.
Yeah.
So assume, and even I didn't practice it very long, not very good at it, did some criminal work. And the first thing that you would look for, even if you're not a very good lawyer, is what possible defenses you have. So somebody comes in and says, this is it. So you just sort of run through your, you know, you try to check off, you know, a motion to suppress, or, you know, this or that.
Right.
So if Trump, you know, he's not going to come to you, so don't worry about it. Trump came to you, and based on what you know about the Mar-a-Lago case, what defenses would come to your mind that are not laughable? Okay. I've asked this question to a lot of high-end lawyers.
So in his case, you know, if he came to me now, and the problem is he's got a record now of things that he has said. You know, for the first thing, if he had come to me early on, it would have been, how about just keeping quiet because stop making things worse by having inconsistent defenses and statements, such as the things are planted or no, I took them because they're mine, or the latest, which appears to be, I really like the classification covers. I just kept them as a memento, which is ridiculous. I mean, I've seen classification covers. Right. There's no reason to have many of them as a memento. The normal defense for somebody who is a CEO type, and it frankly is the kind of thing that I assume President Biden is going to use, is who the hell knows what my staff did? This is a low-level staff problem. When I used to prosecute people at Enron, you know, the hard part is showing knowledge and intent of the senior people, because you usually have so much that's happening at the staff level, which doesn't bubble up. And so it would have been better for him to be saying, you know, I didn't have anything to do with boxing the stuff. I didn't want to take that stuff. It was news to me that it was there. You know, those kinds of things. At this point, I don't really think he has that available to him. And, you know, I wrote with the folks at Just Security, which is an NYU outfit. And
yeah, they're good.
Yeah, they're fantastic. And we wrote a sort of sample Mar-a-Lago prosecution memo, and we went through all of the defenses and we really, really tried to be serious about, you know, anything that we could think of. And essentially all we came down to was he has really good arguments at sentencing as to why he should get a really low sentence or even not do time compared to other cases. But we couldn't come up with any sort of, you know, defense that would really be plausible other than, you know, obviously jury nullification. So, you know, I think at this point, his best defense is sort of political, trying to get a pardon, make sure the case is brought in Florida so that he has a better jury pool. I mean, those are the kinds of things that you'd be focused on. Cause I think this is, I think that the die is largely cast on this one, other than if the Biden situation is going to be this, you know, a gift that allows Trump to once again sort of escape, you know, being held accountable.
Correct. So let the record show that I've asked high-end lawyers everywhere, the entire NYU law school faculty, and no one has been able to come up with a defense for this. That just kind of, it's just kind of amusing, Andrew. But at any rate, so you obviously know Jack Smith, and you obviously know her. Can you tell our listeners that you have confidence that these are thoroughfare people who are not going to drag this crap out forever?
So Jack, you know, by all accounts, and I mean, I know him pretty well. I was the chief of the criminal division at EDNY when he started as in general crimes. He is super tenacious, really aggressive, extremely experienced. I think he has state, federal, international experience. He has prosecuted political leaders internationally for war crimes. I mean, so it's hard to imagine somebody with, you know, better background and experience. And the one thing I really don't think people need to worry about, it was this issue of, gee, is this going to slow things down going from Garland to Jack Smith? And I sort of have the opposite view. I mean, I think Jack is very much going to be triage, focus on what you need to focus on and move on.
How about Rob Herr?
So I don't know Rob Herr as well. We didn't work in the U.S. Attorney's Office together. We overlapped a bit because of this Mueller special counsel investigation. So I don't have a sense of his sort of speed and cutting to the chase. I mean, I think that what he's inherited is a pretty simple case. Frankly, it's like the Mar-a-Lago case. These are not complicated matters. Frankly, I thought that of the Hillary Clinton email investigation, and I think it's really important that those things be done really quickly. In the Hillary Clinton case, I was surprised just how long that took. But I think having a special counsel will move that along faster. The one sort of, I think, somewhat concerning thing about Rob Herr is We've heard a lot about, under the Trump administration, the blurring of the lines between the Department of Justice and the White House. And Rob Herr, when he was the PAYDAG, which is the number two to Rod Rosenstein, he did a press conference announcing a bunch of cases and talking about ongoing cases. And he did that with a lead FBI agent, and he did it from the White House. That is really unheard of. And I know it's just a small example, but it's not, I don't think it's encouraging in terms of norm breaking and understanding the role of the department in the scheme of things, which is to really be apolitical and stepping aside from sort of White House direction.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. So how does this board turn it over to Al? According to Justice Forward, the board of regulation special counsel, how does this end? Let's just assume that at some point he figures what we all figured, that mistakes are made, some aides put some stuff in there. How did you issue a statement saying the investigation is over? What's the legal way this ends? Or I know it could end in an indictment, but that, don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah. Okay. So let's assume that's not where we end up on Biden. It seems to me that there's a couple things. One, Rob Herr could issue a private recommendation, which is what the regulations require, to the Attorney General, and the Attorney General accepts it. The other thing he could do is he could do a sort of Bob Mueller approach, which is, I'm not going to issue a recommendation, except when Bob Mueller did that, it was because he didn't want to recommend for indictment for a sitting president when he thought there was not enough evidence, he was willing to say it. So I think if Rob Herr is going to say that, the Mueller example is an example of that you should go forward and issue that recommendation. And I think the big issue is whether there's a report. And Rob could issue a report on what happened. And I think there'd be a lot of pressure on Merrick Garland to make that public so that people have confidence this was really looked into and there's a report of exactly what was said and who said what to whom.
Thank you. Robert?
You know, as you know, Andrew, there was what was considered to be a very serious investigation by the Manhattan district attorney of Donald Trump's practices about a year ago. Apparently, a great criminal lawyer, Mark Pomerantz, resigned because he thought the new DA was not pursuing it vigorously enough. He has just written a book. I haven't read it because I think it just came out. It has incurred the wrath of the district attorney, Alvin Bragg. Can you tell us anything about it and what your take is and what it's going to say about the Trump case?
So I have not read it either. I think it's sort of very much greatly anticipated. This is one where I know the two prosecutors who are leading the investigation, I know both of them in various ways, not as well as I know Jack Smith, but Mark Pomerantz has a great reputation. Carrie Dunn, who I dealt with a bit when I was in the special counsel's office, is phenomenal. And so you have two incredibly reputable people who resigned apparently over disagreement over what should happen with that case. And by the same token, I know a bunch of the people who are currently in the Manhattan District Attorney's office in leadership, and I think equally highly of them. So I'm really looking forward to this book because I'm very curious about what happened here. Is this just a disagreement that can happen from time to time between reputable people having a different view about the quality and quantity of proof that's necessary to go forward? Or is there something else going on here, a lack of will, poor judgment, et cetera. So we don't really know. I think the latest, which is interesting, is in the Washington Post. There was an article today about Alvin Bragg saying that Mark Pomerantz didn't go through what's called pre-publication review before you go public with information that happened when you were in the office. That is, on the federal level, that is very standard. I mean, even I, of course, did it for my book. I had to go through pre-publication review. It's lengthy, it's painful, but you get through it. And John Bolton, even he went through pre-publication review, and the contretemps he had is that after it was approved by the apolitical people, it went to the White House, who basically said, no, it's not done. And he thought that it was very, very political, and he had a lot of substantiation for that. But even he went through that process. So it'll be really interesting to see what Mark and Simon & Schuster do in response to the parent brag letter to the publisher.
Yeah, it will be. Andrew, you have said in the past that you think it's likely Trump's going to be indicted. Of all the investigations, Fulton County, Mar-a-Lago, January 6th, and the aforementioned Manhattan, you're a great lawyer. Which one should worry him the most?
I think Georgia and Georgia first and Manhattan second. And I say that not because I don't think there is a serious likelihood of his being indicted on one or more indictments at the federal level. It's that both of those state cases are not subject to a presidential pardon. So if there were, for instance, to be a Republican in the White House, whether it's Trump or somebody else in the next election, those charges at the state level stick. And at least in the Georgia charges, they appear to be on the face of it fairly strong. And they, of course, have the Raffensperger tape. And what's great about that tape, not that it's not proof positive, but it does put Trump right in the center with his own voice that the jury will hear. So that he can't, as James was asking me, he can't say, oh, this was just underlings and I didn't really understand. I mean, he's right there pressuring himself and they can hear it. So I think that is the one, if I were his defense counsel, that is the one that I'd be most concerned about.
They also have a much tougher RICO statute down there than the federal RICO statute, which
may
make the case easier. Let me just one. I just want to wrap this one up. It's not all that important. But one of your special charges was Paul Manafort, who you convicted of conspiracy, witness tampering, bank fraud, and tax evasion. He was pardoned by Trump, and he's now written a book claiming he was a political prisoner. Refresh us on Mr. Manafort.
So Paul Manafort was under investigation by the department for over 3 years when the special counsel was appointed. And he engaged in just a wholesale slew of crimes, whether it was sort of political type things, such as being a foreign agent who did not register for years and years, with all sorts of nefarious schemes, sending people to the White House to meet with senators' offices who were actually agents of foreign powers, but undisclosed to them. I mean, just really bad stuff. And then just a lot of financial stuff, tons of bank fraud. The tax fraud was so blatant. He had foreign bank accounts that he falsely said he didn't have, and it was paying for things, Al, like his, millions of dollars of clothing, his weekly maid service, his gardening service in the Hamptons. All of that was paid by his accounts in Cyprus, which, of course, he wasn't paying taxes on. So this was just really blatant stuff where I remember at some point early on when I looked at the tax fraud, I remember turning to Bob Mueller and saying, you know what, if this isn't charged in 2 months, fire me. I'd like to say I was a really great lawyer and a really great investigator, and I wasn't. I mean, this was really blatant stuff.
Easy. I just wanted to get that. I wanted to get that on the record, James.
Well, now, Andrew, we see each other in person. Ask me to tell you a story about how long and how corrupt Paul Manafort has been corrupt, because I got a doozy. I
mean, I've got one too.
His own daughter said everything he got was stolen. I mean, it's kind of hard when your children think they're getting tainted inheritance. But at any rate, I just want to thank you and coming on and being so candid and knowledgeable. And I the one thing I do want to promote is the Just Security website. This is really good stuff. Some of it can get, it's a little law professory and stuff, and it can wear you down some of it, but the stuff there is really, really good analysis. And tell Brian Goodman, I guess it is, all the people that do that, that I'm a regular, follow that site regularly. I think it's quite good. And so I'll
tell them that.
It's honored to have you on the show.
Yeah, well, I'll tell them that, and I don't take any credit for it.
Amen to that, James. And I also want to say, all of you out there who have neighbors or family members or coworkers who still pretend Trump was malign, get Andrew's book, Where Law Ends Inside the Mueller Investigation. I mean, there is no doubt that he's writing about a bunch of crooks. Andrew Weissman, we can't thank you enough for being on this show again and enlightening us, and I'm sure we'll come back to you at some point.
Absolutely.
Look forward to it.
Thank you, counsel. So, Al, one of the things that Andrew Weissman said is that he knows a lot of people in the Manhattan DA's office, and they're quite good lawyers, and that buttresses the fact that our dear friend Walter Dellinger, who represented the Manhattan DA on acquiring the documents, said that they were quite talented people in the Manhattan DA's office. So, this is not a pack of rubes. I mean, they got some good lawyers there. Andrew Weissman and Walter Dellinger just say they have good lawyers. They have good lawyers.
Yeah, it makes you feel better. I just hope that the lead person, the DA, is as tough. But we'll find out. All right, James. Now for the outrage of the week. The Missouri Republican state legislature has been ridiculed for adopting a new dress code that signals out women members they've got to wear a jacket and never be sleeveless, always covering their bare arms. Now, James, in this area, I think dress codes are really stupid. They're relics. But if the U.S. House of Representatives took a look at this, I know, as much as I oppose it, we may not be intimidated by Marjorie Taylor Greene's bulging biceps. And if they extended it to male members, House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jim Jordan requiring him to wear a jacket, he no longer could do his pathetic imitation of tough guy James Cagney. Wearing a jacket, Jim Jordan would be different. Okay, dream on, Albert. It's not going to happen. No worries. And also, Mr. Carville, I want to assure you, there will never be a dress code for politics war room.
Boy, there's nothing turns me on like the sight of a woman's arm. I'm into arm porn, you know.
You've got an arm fetish.
Oh man, do I have an arm fetish? I particularly from the high arm, right before the shoulder. I don't even understand what they're doing, and I actually think sometimes this, if anything, can be slightly helpful. I don't have so much. I've had 10 outrages, but I will make an observation. There is a stampede effect in among all of us. And think of two things that couldn't be enough stories. The rise of China. China is a coming superpower. Its GDP is going to outpace the United States. It shows you that a autocrat with a capitalistic system is just more efficient than messy democracy and constituency groups. And it wouldn't stop. They had hypersonic missiles and we didn't. And all of a sudden, and it kind of didn't happen. It didn't take very long. Now you can't read enough stories about the decline of China, the demographic crisis, the housing crisis, the debt crisis, the COVID crisis. And I don't know. I'm sure somebody saw this coming, but if they did, no one paid attention to them. And then how many times was the word inflation used the week before the election, right? A million. It was all was. Killing inflation is killing buying power inflation. Now, Larry Summers says he thinks we're going to have a soft landing. And you don't see, you know, the inflation is, you know, so far in the last 3 months, it has been unbelievably favorable. And by the way, ours is going down faster than any in the world. And the story just dissipates. And I think that we got to be better. And I mean, the collective we, and I would include you and I in that too. It is a little bit better looking around the corner. I mean, because, I mean, these two stories were just so big and so omnipresent. And then all of a sudden, poof. Boom.
Well, that's James. Two guests. We need to get a really good China hand on, someone who really knows China, and can tell us where it's going and why, if there was this big miscalculation.
Right.
And on inflation, I know our old friend Roger Altman knows a lot about this. Maybe we'll have him on the show sometime next
right.
couple of weeks.
Right. It's more of what causes, you know, what's the example you said, McCarthy gets you the birds on the power line.
Yeah,
right?
yeah.
And I think people listen to our show to some extent that they think we can see around the corner a little bit. On some things we can, but on other things, not so good. We don't flush it out. We too much get caught up in the moment. And I that's just a general observation as to how freaking fast things change.
Okay, yeah. Two guests are coming up, but you're right. All right, now for our listener questions. Again, just a terrific collection this week. A number of them were in things we've just discussed, so I'm going to probably not get to those. But these are both ongoing stories. This is a great question. Ed in Lawrenceville, Georgia says, the story may hurt you, but it's the photo editor who'll kill you. Over the last couple of days, I noticed a huge sudden change in Biden story photos. His mouth is gaping, and in many shots, he looks tired and confused. Gone are the Ray-Bans and the Biden grin. Am I imagining a purposeful thumbs on the scale editorial move?
I'll go to you first because, you know, more about editorial moves. And maybe he's just getting older and his mouth is open more often than it used to be. I don't know.
Well, I think it's two things. It may be that. You know, I'll go back and I tell a story. In 1984, we did a story about 3-4 weeks before the election on Reagan's age and how it worried people. He was, I guess, then what, in his early 70s. And it was amazing for the next couple of days how, particularly on television, the shots of Reagan were totally different than they had been a couple of days beforehand. Now, he ended that problem with a strong debate performance. But I don't think it's – I don't think it's political or partisan, but I think that oftentimes the press follows the zeitgeist at the moment. Biden's in trouble. And you're absolutely right, Ed. Photos can kill you. Photos can hurt you a lot more than stories sometimes.
So when I first started, I went to a seminar in Wichita, and I can't remember the guy, Hank Parkinson, I think was his name, the political consultant. And his big thing is that back then they had a file photo, all right, of a candidate. If it wasn't any good, he would like pay somebody to go take that photo out the file because it just keep running the same one. I don't think it works like that. It's all digital now. But it's one of early things I learned in my career is if you got a bad photo, get it out the file.
yeah. No, it's true. Yeah. Megan in Waukesha, Wisconsin, asked, this is right down our alley, James, should Mallory McMurrow or Alyssa Slotkin run for the opening Senate seat in Michigan? Who would be better to win? We on this show are Mallory McMurrow sycophants. We think she's fabulous. I gather, based on just a little bit of reporting, that she's likely to take a pass on this because Congresswoman Slotkin and maybe one or two others are going to go for it. Maybe that makes sense. But, James, when there's an opening and you don't go for it, it means someone else is going to go for it, and your time may not come as soon as you hope.
Well, I'll just make an observation. I have no idea if it's true or not, but Wisconsin has more place names that are difficult to pronounce than any other state.
This was an easy one, comparatively.
Yeah, comparatively. I mean, it got voted from this place to Wild Counties. I don't even try to pronounce that. The truth of the matter is there's a staggering amount of female Democratic talent in Michigan, led by none other than Big Gretch. And, yeah, I don't know, because, you know, you got the AG, the Secretary of State, the, mm-hmm. you know, Congress, whatever. I mean, that's that the whole Michigan experience is a real testament to how a party can be really effective. And so maybe there's no room at the top, but I suspect that our dear friend Senator McMurrow will be at the top before long.
Yeah, I agree.
One way or the other.
Bob in Boise, Idaho, says if President Biden decides to run in 2024, all signs are he's going to, can he replace Kamala Harris, he says, with former President Barack Obama? I think we agree that's a non-starter, but...
Constitutionally, I don't think it could happen.
I don't think it can either. If he went through Obama family, he should go to Michelle. But do you think there's any chance he would dump Harris?
You know, well, this is something that we know. It's not gossip. They really did not want her, all right? This was a political calculation. And, of course, should he decide that he's going to run for re-election, the vice president becomes a elevated position. It's something they have to consider. It's something that they have to consider, but... And I'm sure that Vice President Harris knows all of this, and it's difficult. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, it is.
And it's kind of hard to see that. I don't know. It's a difficult question.
It is. He reportedly has told people at times, you know, he wishes he would have picked Whitmer. But in any event, I'll tell you one story, James, about presidents and vice presidents. Jerry Ford was a very good friend of was close to a very good friend of mine in Vail, Colorado, Rod Slifer. And after Ford lost in 76, Rod said to President Ford, you know, if you'd picked Bill Ruckelshaus instead of Bob Dole, you know, maybe you could have won. And Ford just dismissed it out of hand, said, no one votes for the vice presidency. You're just wrong. That's it. Fast forward 15 years later, and Rod and Jerry Ford are talking, and Ford has just called George H.W. Bush to suggest that he replace Dan Quayle on the ticket. So it all depends on where you are.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of thinking how William Ruckelshaus would have gotten more than Bob Dole. I think Gerald Ford was correct in that assessment. And, relieved when President Bush, you know, left Quayle there, because it was just like he's going to continue doing the same thing he's always done. I would have been more fearful if he'd have put somebody else to say, hey, look, I'm going with the office. But it's going to be a difficult decision for Biden and his people. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, it will be. James, actually the next question is to me. It comes from Trudy in Kalua'i, Hawaii. And this is a good question. This is really a great issue. She says, why have we allowed Republicans to lie about the funding for the IRS? Republicans claim it'll find 87,000 IRS agents who will come after middle-class individuals and small businesses, when in fact the agency will result in more revenue since big earners won't be able to cheat as much. How come Democrats let them get away with that? You are absolutely right, Trudy. Those 87,000, first of all, they're not all new audit agents. They have a terrible IT system over there. A lot of it will go to that. They desperately need various support staff over there. They're undermanned. And I forget the exact figure, James, but Larry Summers and others have said for every extra dollar they get of auditing rich tax cheats, and that's what they'll do, for every extra dollar every extra dollar spent on an order to get that, they bring in another $4 or $5. So it's a terrific investment. And the Republicans, in voting to kill that, it won't won't happen because the Senate and Biden won't go along. They voted to kill the extra, I think, $80 billion over 10 years. And the CBO said it will cost the taxpayers $114 million. So the first thing House Republicans did was increase the deficit by $34 million in order to protect a lot of their rich contributors.
Well, I will give you enormous credit. You've been on this for a long time, and Trudy. By the way, I love that name. I had a dear friend from Carville named Trudy who died a few years ago. But
Trudy in Hawaii,
I love that name. It's so blatant and so repetitive. They just, you got to understand, they don't care. They don't give a shit if they lie. If you point out the fact that they're lying and you put proof of it, they just say it 10 times more. And I think the reason is, I guess, their people want to be lied to. They demand it. They pay for it. So if you think let's say you have a right-wing radio show, all right? By the way, that's a highly competitive market. And you say, look, this is really doesn't affect the average guy. Look, if you're working stiff, they take out your taxes when you get your check. You don't have any sort of option. If you're a multimillionaire, billionaire, that's not the way it works. And, you know, there's all kinds of shady things you can do. They're never going to say that.
Right.
Because there is a large market that spends a lot of money that demands to be lied to. And there are people that fulfill that market and tell them the lies that they want to hear. That's what's driving all of this. This is the marketplace of ideas where a good 30% of this country, you know, God damn it, I want to be told, you know, I want to be told what I want to hear, not what is the truth. So they give it to you.
Yeah, they sure do. James, we have our unwritten rule in this program. The questions from New Orleans go to you. So Red in New Orleans says,
right.
We thankfully have more young and minority Democratic representatives, candidates like Maxwell Frost in Florida. What more can be done to recruit more federal representatives of color and young people who are mainstream Democrats? It seems more federal politicians in the mold of Governor Wes Moore or John Ossoff in Congress would make it harder to paint Democrats as radical or even old.
You know, I listened to Maxwell Frost. He was doing an interview, and he's clearly to the left of me, but he's good. The guy gave a really good, honest interview in, you know, how he, you know, paid the papers. Campaigner's credit card, he didn't have any money, he had trouble finding housing. And he was very, you know, that he had aspirational goals and he understood that it was going to take work and time. I'm kind of, like I said, he's clearly to the left of me, but I'm kind of impressed with this guy. I really am.
Yeah.
You're right, Wes Moore is a good example. You know, you got to keep, you know, punching up. And, you know, if you look at the whole Democratic caucus, I can't tell you it looks like America, but it sure is starting to look like America.
And a lot of young talent there, too.
But we have got to figure out how that we increase black turnout and particularly young black turnout, because it was abysmal. And it was abysmal in Wisconsin, where you had Mandela Barnes, who was clearly a leftist, you know, person of color, and they just didn't come.
Right.
And they didn't come in North Carolina. They didn't come in Florida. And I think the answer to this question is important, and it's not easy, and it's probably multiple answers, but if our listeners are listening to this, if you want to send us a letter saying what you think, maybe we can get it on and get your thoughts on it, because my gut tells me, but I don't know this, that the Democrats' reluctance to talk about crime, which is, according to the Pew poll, 81% of blacks think this is a huge issue in their neighborhoods, I think maybe showed ourselves out of touch. But that's only, some people say we should have, you know, put voting rights more front and center. I'm open to any explanation.
I wish we would have. I just didn't, you know, they weren't the votes. That's the problem with that.
I don't have the answer, but somebody ought to, has got to find out what the answer or answers are, because it is a freaking problem.
Sure is. David in Livingston, New Jersey, says, if the House Republicans want to play Russian roulette with the debt ceiling and federal spending, let them start to see the consequences. Why not the president and Democrats immediately identify and implement spending cuts that target Republican leadership districts and key members? Couple, David, this is such a big issue right now. First of all, is context on spending is the same as taxes. Russell Long used to say a tax reform. It was really don't tax you, don't tax me, tax that fellow there under the tree. And what these Republicans want to cut are things that don't affect them or their districts. The danger, and I think politically it's a loser for them. I think if they go and the United States, there's a shutdown, the United States goes into default, they're going to lose. There's a danger, though, because we're going to lose, too. I think markets will crater. I think it's just it is an incredibly dangerous situation. This is not an argument over spending. And if you want to cut spending, if that's their goal, then do it in appropriations bills, spending bills. There's a vehicle for that. The debt ceiling has nothing to do with current or future spending. It only covers past spending. And it is sheer dangerous demagoguery to be playing Russian roulette, as you put it, David, on this issue.
Words count, all right? So I have a favorability scale, and I use the term government spending. All right. A lot of people respond, but you know, just boom, don't call it. Put spending on programs like Social Security and Medicare. Bingo. It goes off the chart, all right? So don't say they are forcing this to cut Social Security and Medicare. That's exactly what this is all about. That's the most unpopular thing you can do. And, you know, bottom of the deck, we need to actually get Roger Altman on the show pretty soon, because there's just a lot of economic stuff that we'll need him to walk us through.
Right. But
always, always, always specify the kind of spending that they want to cut. Because you just give generic, well, we got to get government spending under control. And, you know, we got to run the government like a household. And all that shit you hear, all right? That people will go, well, no, it's just that they want to cut Social Security and Medicare. Uh-oh, no, I don't do that. Bad idea. Be very, very focused. You know, Mark Twain once said the difference between the right word and the nearly right word is the difference between lightning and a lightning bug. The difference between government spending and cuts to Social Security and Medicare, one is the lightning bug, one is lightning.
It sure is.
A little sticking thing here.
James, our final question comes. Now, Richard, I'm going to let you get away with this because he says, Richard, in the greater USA. Well, I'm sorry. We got some great questions from New Zealand and Australia, but most of them are from the greater USA. So if you want any more questions, Richard, a one-time exception, tell us where you're from. Richard wants to know, why don't Democrats hire the same highly effective creators that make up the Lincoln Project's hard-hitting, clever advertising spots?
Well, you know, they are very clever spots. I like a lot of those guys. And there's a difference between a clever spot and an effective spot.
Right.
All right. And what the Lincoln Project does is they get under Trump's skin. All right. And they get under, and they're very effective, very creative about it. I think more effective spots are used kind of ordinary people, et cetera, but I know them, I'll give them enormous credit. They didn't look back. Some of them are good friends of mine, and they're very creative people. But sometimes, you know, just slugging it out is better politics.
Yeah,
I'm not saying that they're not helpful at all.
Keep those questions coming in. Those we didn't get to this week, we'll try to get to next week. Richard, if you're right again, tell us where you're from. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the link to our sponsor, Lomi, in the show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it makes this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Now, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.